And in today's episode, we join Gordon as he begins his RAF training, having signed up at the beginning of the war.
Lord's Cricket Ground, RAF Aircrew Reception. All we recruits had to go through various procedures, medical checks, inoculations galore. We were billeted in a big block of flats in St John's Wood, and there I was put in a room with two others. After a few days here, we were posted, in our brand new uniforms, to an initial training wing, ITW. These were mostly situated in seaside resorts, and we were sent to Torquay. On arrival, to our great delight, the three of us were together in a hotel right on the cliff top, and our room had a marvellous view all the way around Torbay. Then the work started in earnest. Every day we were inspected by the CO and marched downtown, where our instruction took place. The CO, a Canadian, had a thing about highly polished shoes, and he meant spit and polish. One day he took one of his own shoes off and showed us how it was done. We had a nasty little drill corporal who insisted on us marching as one. The RAF marches faster than the army for some reason, 140 paces to the minute, and that took some doing coming up the steep hill after classes. The ITW experience consisted mostly of learning the basics of navigation, sending messages in Morse code and various other things, plus plenty of drill and PT. At the end of the course, which lasted about 6 weeks, we had a passing out party, which for me was well named. I'd always been brought up to believe that alcohol was the scourge of the world, so when I told my mates that I didn't touch beer, etc., I was told I would like the apple drink. Oh yes, that was that green, and you will have guessed. I was plied with scrumpy until I passed out, and so learnt my first lesson in drinking.
I might point out that so far we'd all been budding pilots or navigators. The majority, wanting to be pilots, were sent off to a short basic flying course to assess their suitability for flying. Those thought unsuitable were usually remustered as navigators, joining those like myself who wanted to be navigators in the first place. Now, we should be posted to South Africa, Rhodesia or Canada for advanced training, but due to the huge losses of ships, we had to wait for transport. Meantime, we had to parade each morning, do some drill on their various chores around the camp, such as coal heaving, spud bashing, which was peeling, and the favourite, working in the officer's mess. This went on for weeks, and we eventually became quite adept at skivvying. This went on for weeks, and we eventually became quite adept at skivvying. It was thought we might benefit from some toughening up, so about 100 of us were posted to the RAF Regiment training centre at Whitley Bay. We were the first aircrew cadets to undergo this assault course training, and the regiment lads really put us through it. It was certainly tough going. I personally had never done anything so energetic, but we all came out at the end with smiles on our faces, and the regiment boys were very impressed.
Eventually we went by train to Greenock on the Clyde and embarked on a large liner called the Empress of Scotland. We still had no idea where we were going, as we'd been issued with several items of tropical gear. The voyage, which took about 7 days, was, thank God, fairly uneventful. Sleeping was a bit tricky, as a lot of us were in bunks on the promenade deck, but we only had one really rough day. At one stage, the weather seemed to be getting warmer, so we thought we would be going to Africa. But a few days later it got colder, and we even sighted some icebergs. Then we spotted the New York skyline and were able to enjoy the spectacle of sailing past the Statue of Liberty and up the Hudson River to our dock. The next morning we boarded a train for a trip to Moncton in New Brunswick. It was now January, very cold, and the ground was well covered with snow. Moncton itself was a miserable place, and there was little to do in the camp, a holding camp solely for aircrew trainees passing through. After a couple of weeks, I was allotted to the Royal Canadian Air Force Station, No. 1 Canadian Navigation School, Rivers, Manitoba. We were put on a trans-Canadian train, which was to be our home for the best part of the next 3 days. It was not exactly luxurious. At least we got some decent food. Some things like bananas and oranges, which we hadn't seen since before the war. The first part of the journey was at night, but we arrived at Montreal around lunchtime. We stopped here for about 4 to 5 hours and could have gone into town, but as it was still bitterly cold and snowy, we preferred the warmth of the station. A couple of chaps came along the train with photo albums of pretty girls who would like our company. We didn't take up the offer, but to show my ignorance, it had to be explained to me what they wanted to meet us for.
The next part of the journey was quite attractive, with lots of forest interspersed with lakes, and next morning it was still woods and lakes. After miles and miles of this, we ran out into the enormous flat plain of the prairies. The next stop was Winnipeg, the capital of Manitoba, for 3 to 4 hours. We were treated to a reception by, I suppose, the equivalent of the WVS. They gave us tea and cakes, the like of which we hadn't seen for years, and we were given phone numbers of people who would put us up in their homes if we came into Winnipeg on a weekend pass. After this, we set off again, mostly by night. Finally, we arrived at Rivers. It was night time, and the first impression was that we'd been dropped in the middle of nowhere, as apart from the station, there were only a few buildings. 25 of us were taken by bus to No. 1 CNS, about 15 miles away, which was to be our home for the next 6 months. Next day, we were introduced to our new home, which was very impressive, very well laid out, and apart from the classrooms and the airfield, there was a magnificent restaurant, a cinema, a 10-lane bowling alley, a library, a music room, you name it, they seemed to have it. The course itself was intensive classroom work interspersed with lots of flying. This was done in Anson's, an older but well-respected training plane, and was conducted over the prairies, which stretched for hundreds of miles without any distinguishing marks, so were ideal for testing one's navigation ability. In the middle of the course, we were given a weekend pass, 3 days, so three of us decided to go into Winnipeg, only 500 miles. Having got to the station early in the morning, we were told that, from when we could see the smoke on the horizon, there would be plenty of time to have breakfast, as it would be the best part of 2 hours before it arrived. It was that flat, as far as the eye could see. Arriving in Winnipeg, two of us rang one of the phone numbers we'd been given on our stop there. They came and picked us up, took us to their lovely home, and invited us to stay with them for the weekend. They took us out on a tour of the city and looked after us right royally. Winnipeg was not a very large city, but was very well laid out and spotlessly clean. For us, the main attractions were the shops, fully stocked, with lots of things which we'd almost forgotten existed in wartime Britain. And would you believe it, one of the two biggest department stores was Simpsons.
Back at Rivers, the work became more intensive, particularly the flying, until eventually we had exams. I did very well, and the top dozen or so were given interviews by a group of the top brass. As a result of this, seven of us were awarded commissions. So I arrived at Rivers as a Lance Corporal and left as a pilot officer. The only difference to our uniform initially was a narrow blue band to put on our epaulettes, the rest to be done when we got home. We had to go home via the dreaded Moncton, which took 3 days, but we had a week to get there, so the three of us decided to stop off in Winnipeg for a couple of days to revisit our friends and do some shopping, including lots of record albums. They really were albums then, quite heavy with 3 or 4 shellac 78 RPM records. Then by train to Toronto and a bus to Niagara Falls, and spent another 2 days seeing all the sights, and very impressed we were. We went on the boat right up to the falls, did the walk under them, saw where Blondin had walked over them. We did the lot. We had another long, dreary wait at Moncton, awaiting a ship to take us home. As U-boat attacks had been preying on transatlantic shipping, it had been decided that they would only use the fastest liners, as it was hoped that they would outrun the U-boats. At least this time I could use the officers' mess. After about 3 weeks, we moved to an American holding camp called Camp Miles Standish, somewhere near Boston. We could not leave the camp as we might be required to depart at short notice. But quite honestly, we didn't need to, as this place was a revelation, especially living in the officers' club, as they called it. It was like a 5-star hotel with a lot more facilities thrown in. A fully equipped theatre where Broadway stars often appeared, 2 cinemas, and all the sporting facilities you could dream of. Our hosts were exceedingly friendly. Unfortunately, we were only there for 3 days, and then off to New York and a ship to take us home. And what a ship! It was the Queen Elizabeth, the original one, just about the biggest and the fastest liner.
As you can imagine, it was a pretty tight squeeze, even on a monster like this. I suppose we were the lucky ones. We had individual hammocks on the promenade deck, whereas most of the Yanks had to crowd together on mattresses in hundreds on the floors of the larger rooms and decks. For eating, we were allotted 2 times, 10 a.m. or 4:30 for our meals in great big dining rooms. The trip took 5 days and wasn't without incident. About 2 days out, the ship started zigzagging, the tactic used when U-boats were around. We encountered some very stormy weather. In peacetime, the ship was fitted with stabilisers to counteract the rough seas, but they had been removed to achieve greater speed. Regardless of its size, the ship seemed to be tossed about like a cork. At least it made more room in the dining hall. Well, the last part of the journey was uneventful. They reckoned the Queen Elizabeth could outrun any U-boat. One thing amused us. Several of the Yanks we spoke to thought the Queen Elizabeth must be an American ship, as who but they could have built the largest in the world. Presumably, to avoid possible bombing in the south, we eventually anchored in the River Clyde near Greenock and had to be taken off in lighters. We're taken to Harrogate in Yorkshire, where all those returning from overseas postings were sorted out and allotted to the next move. I was posted to Moreton Valence, a small wartime airfield between Cheltenham and Gloucester, where I spent a couple of months, once again flying in Anson's, getting used to navigating over very different terrain to the prairies. The most interesting thing here was something happening in a hangar over to the other side of the airfield. Till then, we had only seen propeller-driven aeroplanes, but out of that hangar came a peculiar-looking plane. Till then, we had only seen propeller-driven aeroplanes, but out of that hangar came a particular-looking plane. It had no props, only a big nose hole in the nose. When it took off, it not only made a noise to wake the dead, but literally climbed almost vertically. It was the Gloucester E-4, the first jet. At the time, it was the talking point of everyone within earshot, but it was quite a while before we realised that this was the beginning of a new era in flying.